Thursday, November 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as Joe Biden plans to move to the White House, President Donald Trump remains defiant.
The president today again claimed on Twitter he actually won, raising new and unsupported claims of corruption and dishonesty.
The U.S. sets another daily record of coronavirus cases as the global pandemic copes with another wave.
We are in trouble. Our local and state healthcare resources are approaching their limits.
Also ahead, Pope Francis vows to uproot the evil of clerical sexual abuse. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden continues to lay the groundwork for his new administration as President Donald Trump pursues a flurry of long-shot lawsuits challenging the election results in an effort to cling to power. Trump has declined to concede, instead lodging unsupported charges of election fraud that have gained little traction. Both the current and future president paid tribute to American service members Wednesday for Veterans Day.
VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara reports.
On Veterans Day in the United States, President Donald Trump laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery, while President-elect Joe Biden visited the Philadelphia Korean War Memorial. Neither man gave remarks. Trump refuses to concede after last week's presidential election showed Biden to be the projected winner. The president declared on Twitter that we will win. With the state of Alaska being called for Trump, he now has 217 electoral votes, while Biden has 279. A candidate needs a minimum of 270 to win. Three states have not yet been called: Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina. On top of various legal challenges already filed in several battleground states claiming voter fraud, the Trump campaign has launched a new lawsuit aiming to block certification of the election results in Pennsylvania. Paul Schiff Bergman is a professor of law at George Washington University Law School.
It is possible that if they kick up enough dust and enough allegations and uncertainty, that they could potentially convince Republican-controlled legislatures to seat a rival slate of electors that are opposite of what the votes in the state and the voters in the state called for. That would be an extraordinarily extreme step. It would really be a coup against the American people and a destruction of the democratic process.
Meanwhile, two states are headed for a recount, Wisconsin and Georgia. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger.
With the margin being so close, it will require a full by-hand recount in each county. This will help build confidence. It will be an audit, a recount, and a re-canvass all at once.
The Trump campaign celebrated the announcement with campaign communications director Tim Murtaugh saying, "This is an important first step in the process to ensure that the election was fair and that every legal vote was counted." So far, none of the legal challenges mounted by the Trump campaign has succeeded in providing evidence for their claim of ballot count fraud, something Democrats are eager to point out.
We are a week out, and the president is still desperately searching for evidence of fraud. He won't find it because it doesn't exist.
Even if Trump is successful in some of his lawsuits and recount demands, analysts say it's unlikely to overturn Biden's victory. Republican strategist Rob Stutzman.
It does appear reasonable what the media, both the left-leaning and right-leaning media, have concluded, that it is impossible for Trump to make up the deficit he now faces in key states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nevada.
By law, state electors have to formally cast their votes for president and vice president in mid-December. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
A surge of coronavirus infections is showing no sign of slowing in the United States after a daily record number of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations. Dr. Julie Watson, a vice president of Integress Health, which operates 18 hospitals in Oklahoma, says the recent surge in COVID cases has pushed that state's healthcare system to the limit.
And if nothing is done soon to slow the rise in cases, our hospitals will be more overwhelmed than they already are, and we won't be able to be there for all of those who need it.
As the AP's Ed Donahue reports, steps are being taken across the country to try to stop the latest spread of the coronavirus.
In New York, restaurants, bars, and gyms will have to close by 10 p.m. No private gatherings of more than 10 people. In Indiana,
we are in the midst of a second surge.
Governor Eric Holcomb is bringing back some restrictions that limit crowd sizes and extends a mask mandate.
Unfortunately, too many of us and around the country have let our guards down and either assumed we won't get it, or if we do, so be it.
In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Mayor Paul Ten Haken said no to a mask mandate.
I believe the small uptick in compliance we see from this, or we will see, are not worth the community division that this will create.
Violators would have been fined $50. I'm Ed Donahue.
The United Nations warns global hunger is reaching new heights as COVID-19 devastates economies around the world. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, a report by the World Food Program, an international organization for migration, says severe food shortages are forcing millions of people to migrate in search of work to feed their families.
Communities most at risk are those riven by conflict, violence, and natural disasters. The report says efforts to curb COVID-19 have led to unprecedented restrictions on mobility, trade, and economic activity, triggering a global recession and causing hunger to surge. The World Food Program projects a staggering 80% increase in the number of acutely food insecure people from pre-COVID-19 levels of 149 million to 270 million by the end of the year. The joint WFP-IOM report finds the world's 164 million migrant workers, especially those in the informal sector, are among those worst hit by the pandemic. IOM spokeswoman Angela Wells says migrant workers, who often work on a temporary seasonal basis for little money and no social protection, are particularly vulnerable.
More than 94,000 travel restrictions in over 220 countries, territories, or areas put in place to contain the spread of the disease have limited opportunities for people to move, work, and afford food and other basic needs. Without sustained income, the report warns that many will be pushed to return home, which will cause a significant drop in remittances.
The report estimates remittances provide an essential lifeline for around 800 million, or 1 in 9 people in the world. The World Bank expects remittances to drop by as much as 14% worldwide in 2020. WFP spokesman Thompson Theory says remittances from international migrants play a crucial role in supporting families. He says hunger inevitably will increase without that source of income.
Based on our analysis, WFP has projected that the remittance losses alone could leave an additional 33 million people at risk of hunger across the 79 countries covered by this analysis. And our offices are reporting that 1 in 5 households said that they used remittances entirely to buy food.
The two agencies are calling on the international community to respond to the immediate and rising humanitarian needs of the hundreds of millions of people struggling to survive the devastating socioeconomic impacts of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The positive report this week of a potential COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer Pharmaceutical and BioNTech, its German partner, that so far appears to be 90% effective, is bringing renewed hope for a light at the end of the pandemic tunnel. Pfizer's work is only one of several scientific efforts worldwide to develop an effective COVID-19 vaccine. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Dr. Jesse Goodman, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., who says he's encouraged by the announcement, but that there is still much work to be done.
I think it is very promising and exciting, but there's just really minimal data at this point. Pfizer has just basically issued a press release from the early part of its clinical trial.
What is Pfizer actually saying?
What they are saying is that comparing a group of recipients in the trial, one who got the vaccine, another who got the placebo, that receiving the vaccine reduced the frequency of illness by about 90% or more. It's a pretty small amount of data, but it's extremely promising so long as it's all confirmed.
Where are the major gaps in our understanding of this vaccine?
A big thing we don't know is how long will this protection last. Also, the company did not report any details, including on safety. They stated that they've been told there were no significant safety concerns or signals, but we still don't have information reported on that. And for them to have the minimum that FDA would require, even for an emergency use authorization, which is far short of an approval, they're going to need several weeks more data. But all those things said, what it does convincingly tell us is that a vaccine designed in this way to get the body to react to what's called the spike protein of the coronavirus can help protect us against future illness. So that's a major step forward. It suggests that other vaccines, which are in testing based on the same principle against the same virus protein, sort of raises our hopes for their success.
Johnson & Johnson, I know, is a major player.
That vaccine, as well as AstraZeneca's, are based on using other viruses, in this case a harmless virus, and substitute it for the gene for the spike protein. But essentially, it does the same thing. It's using a harmless virus to make this protein, which the body then reacts to and remembers. The other more traditional candidates, like particularly the recombinant proteins that are made in a factory, but sort of in the same way. The genes are put into bacteria or yeast or insect cells or whatever, and the protein is made in the factory rather than in the body from the RNA. Those are in many, many approved vaccines using technologies and approaches that have been around for a long time and that are tried and true. They're slower, but they're more certain.
And globally, many of these competing companies are cooperating with each other.
There already is a lot of collaboration, and we can't predict which vaccine may be best among all these, whether there may be certain vaccines that are better for certain populations like the elderly. That's one of the reasons it's super important that these clinical trials get completed so we have a good understanding of every one of these promising vaccines and then understand how they compare to each other and what's best for what population.
How does this timeline compare with the H1N1 response that you oversaw when you were the chief scientist at the FDA under President Obama? H1N1, of course, is a form of influenza or the flu.
In 2009 with H1N1, it was similar or shorter, but we knew we were just making another influenza vaccine. So even though it was a unique strain, we could use the technologies and the manufacturing processes that had been in use for 40 plus years and have a lot of confidence in that. We didn't know how many doses it would take or what dose, but we knew what could help protect people against disease. With this, to go from discovering a brand new disease and just having the gene sequence, let's say in January, to having data in November suggesting we have an effective vaccine, that is extraordinary. We have a long way to go, but I think this gives an indication of the promise of some of these new technologies and what the world can do working together when they're determined.
Dr. Jesse Goodman, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He was a chief scientist at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, where he led the agency's response to the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga made his first appearance on Wednesday before a United Nations tribunal in The Hague. Kabuga, a former radio station owner and tea and coffee tycoon, was arrested in a Paris suburb in May after a more than two-decade manhunt. The 85-year-old is accused of financing and arming ethnic Hutu militias that killed some 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus during a 100-day period in 1994. Paris-based reporter Catherine Field has been closely following the case and joins us now for the very latest. Catherine, he's 85 and he apparently is pretty frail. Describe the scene and Mr. Kabuga's appearance.
Mr. Kabuga was brought into the courtroom in a wheelchair. He was wearing a three-piece suit, very well turned out. He followed the proceedings but did not speak at any time other than to tell his defense lawyer that he could hear the translation of the court proceeding. He looked frail, and the defense lawyers were saying that this is a man who is psychologically and mentally very frail and is finding the process very tiring. They said that one of the problems when they read the indictments to him was that he He was tired. It was difficult for him to follow it.
Tell us a little bit about that. This was his first appearance, but what was this hearing actually about?
It was a pretrial hearing just to ascertain where it is now with investigations into the prosecution, what the prosecution is looking at, and to see where it is with witnesses, to make sure also that Monsieur Kabuga knows what is going to be happening in the months ahead. And the question that the presiding judge put to Monsieur Kabuga was, do you understand these 7 counts that you are charged with? Those are 5 relating to genocide and 2 relating to crimes against humanity. And Mr. Kabuga's lawyer said he understood them and he knew some of them, at which stage the judge said, okay, well, we are now going to read you the indictment. And that took 1 hour and 10 minutes for this indictment to be read. And the main point of it was, through it all, that they found on every count that Mr. Kabuga could have used his power, his influence, and his position of authority to prevent broadcasts against the Tutsis, to prevent attacks against Tutsis, but that he failed not only to stop these broadcasts, but he failed to report to police what was being done, what people were being asked to do against Tutsis. And through this, he failed to stop the killing, harming, and mistreatment of Tutsis.
Did he enter a plea?
No, he didn't. His lawyer said that he would not be speaking, and therefore the court registered a plea of not guilty.
And so where does this case go from here?
Now we are looking at the prosecution getting everything together, getting witness statements again, making sure of witness protection. Presiding judge did, however, make a point of saying to both the prosecution and the defense that he expects this case to be dealt with speedily because he's seen too many of these types of cases take too long to come to court.
His victims and victim survivors have waited a very long time to see any sort of justice, and he's 85 years old, so I'm sure that also is potentially playing a role in why the judge wants this to be expeditious.
Oh, indeed. Let's not forget that it was a 26-year-long manhunt for Monsieur Kabuga, so age, as well as how long it's taken, and the fact that some of these UN tribunals, particularly that came up in court, they're really having trouble finding the funding to be able to continue these prosecutions. So they really do realize that it's difficult to get these prosecutions and it's difficult to get the support they need, given that it is so long since the genocide took place and that some countries are not giving as much money to the UN for this as they used to.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much as always. France and Germany have called for much stronger external border security following recent terror attacks in Europe. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, experts say such measures alone are unlikely to solve the problem.
The spate of attacks began in Paris on October 16th when teacher Samuel Paty was beheaded by Chechen teenager Abdulak Anzarov. Less than 2 weeks later, a Tunisian man fatally stabbed 3 people in a church in the French city of Nice. He had arrived from Tunisia as a migrant via Italy. And on November 2nd, Islamic State sympathizer Kuchtim Fejulay shot and killed 4 people in Vienna. The leaders of those countries, along with other European heads of state and officials, met Tuesday to discuss their response. France and Germany called for much tighter security on the border of Europe's passport-free travel area, known as the Schengen area.
Il ne s'agit pas de réduire, retrancher le droit d'asile, comme vous l'avez dit.
French President Emmanuel Macron said it's not about reducing or cutting down the right to asylum, but it's clearly about implementing it fully and fighting the pathways to misappropriate it and to better protect our common exterior borders. The terrorists in both Nice and Vienna had moved freely between Schengen countries. Securing the external border won't necessarily solve the problem, says terror analyst Raffaello Pantucci.
As we've seen repeatedly in the past, you know, terror attacks tend to come from within. And I think the last incident that we saw in Austria was another example of this in many ways. While the individual involved may be a second-generation immigrant, he was actually born in Austria.
So how should governments tackle the threat of homegrown radicalization? Europe is proposing new laws to crack down on internet companies hosting extremist content.
Aber in dem Moment, wo sie den Hinweis kriegen, dass dort etwas
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the moment they are given evidence that there is something in their sites that is criminal or damaging, they have to react straight away and quickly. The EU meeting took place on the fifth anniversary of the coordinated terror attacks in Paris, when 9 attackers killed 130 people. Since then, most attacks in Europe have been carried out by so-called lone wolf terrorists. Again, terror analyst Raffaello Pantucci.
It's infinitely better place to be than seeing large-scale attacks like we saw in Paris or Madrid or London earlier these decades.
The 27 European Union heads of state are due to meet again in December to decide concrete steps on tackling the terror threat. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Pope Francis pledged once again Wednesday to rid the Catholic Church of sexual abuse one day after the Vatican reached its much-anticipated report on the years of cover-up by high-ranking church members on the illegal and wrongful behavior by former Washington Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
Rinnovo la mia vicinanza alle vittime di ogni abuso.
Pope Francis renewed the commitment Wednesday of the Catholic Church to uproot the evil of sexual abuse and express solidarity with victims. His words were followed by a minute of silent prayer at the end of the weekly general audience from the library of the Vatican's Apostolic Palace. The Pope's words came one day after the Vatican published a report that he ordered in October 2018, saying he was concerned by the confusion among Catholics about what he called the painful case of former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. In the report, the Vatican admits its failures to take appropriate action following widespread claims of McCarrick's sexual abuse of minors and adults over many years. The 449-page report on the Holy See's institutional knowledge and decision-making process related to former Cardinal Theodore Edgar McCarrick from 1930 to 2017 is based on the interviews of more than 90 witnesses, including cardinals, bishops, American seminarians, and priests. The Vatican said no limit was placed on the examination of documents and the questioning of individuals or the expenditure of resources necessary to carry out the investigation. McCarrick was one of the most popular and powerful members of the Catholic Church in the United States. It was Pope John Paul II, now a saint, who appointed him Archbishop of Washington in 2000 and then cardinal early the following year. He said he believed a letter written by McCarrick in which he denied any wrongdoing. Under Pope Benedict's watch, McCarrick resigned in 2006 as Archbishop of Washington upon reaching the customary age limit of 75, but continued to remain active. Benedict also did not act on the sexual misconduct allegations and opted against opening a canonical process while encouraging McCarrick to keep a low profile as he continued to be active in the church. It was Pope Francis who finally took action with an investigation and canonical trial after a former altar boy came forward in 2017 with a strong claim that McCarrick had molested him during preparations for Christmas Mass 35 years earlier. The outcome was the cardinal's defrocking in 2019. The once respected and almighty cardinal, now 90 years of age, has never been criminally charged. McCarrick now lives in isolation at an undisclosed location as a layman. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Yeah.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. Australia's most famous radio telescope that played a key role in televising the Apollo 11 moon landing in 1969 has been given a new Aboriginal name. Known as the Dish, the telescope near Parkes in New South Wales, 380 kilometers west of Sydney, will also be called Murriyang, meaning Sky World in the local indigenous language. We hear more now from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
The Parkes Observatory has three telescopes. All have been given new Aboriginal names in respect of the astronomical knowledge of Australia's original inhabitants, whose stories of creation, known as the Dreaming, are told by the stars. The largest telescope, which has discovered hundreds of new galaxies and rapidly spinning neutron stars called pulsars, is also to be known as Murriyang, or Sky World. The others have Aboriginal names meaning smart eye and smart dish. Dr. John Reynolds is the director of the Australia Telescope National Facility, which is run by the National Science Agency, the CSIRO.
I think the bestowing of traditional names is very significant because not only does it recognise the traditional custodians of the land where the telescopes sit, but it highlights the link between the oldest science, astronomy, and the longest continuous civilization in the world that has been practicing astronomy for generations. The new name for the familiar Parkes dish, the big 64 metre, is Murriyang, which represents the sky world in the Wiradjuri Dreaming.
The names were chosen by Wiradjuri elders, who say it's one of their proudest moments. While it's operated mainly for astronomy research, the Parkes telescope has a long history of being contracted by international space agencies to track and receive data from spacecraft. In 2012, it helped to monitor NASA's Curiosity rover during its descent onto the surface of Mars. But perhaps its most famous mission was its part in receiving television signals on a momentous day in July 1969, during the Apollo 11 moon landing. The story was made into a popular movie, The Dish, in 2000, which helped to cement the facility's legendary status in Australian science. The telescope weighs 1,000 tonnes and only receives signals from space, but never sends them. It was officially opened in October 1961. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Britain will hold what it describes as a blockbuster weekend of celebrations in the summer of 2022, featuring an extra day's public holiday to mark Queen Elizabeth's 70th anniversary on the throne. The 94-year-old is the longest reigning monarch in British history. The government says the events to mark her platinum jubilee will mix traditional British pageantry with cutting-edge technological displays, along with other nationwide fanfare. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.